Washington, D.C. This is Warbird Radio.
On this episode of Warbird Radio Presents, we're going to hear an amazing story of mercy in the midst of the brutality of the Battle of the Bulge. Stay tuned. Warbird Radio Presents, the Ed Cottrell story, starts now. I'm John Mollison, and I interview old guys, draw their airplanes, and sometimes I'm lucky enough to hit the record button and let you hear what I hear. Deep down, I think everyone wants to believe that somewhere in the midst of humanity's cruelty, the best of us can thrive. When I began my interview with Ed Cottrell, I knew he was a P-47 pilot, and I knew he flew missions against the German advance in the Battle of the Bulge. That alone put him in an eyewitness spot on one of the most fascinating battles of World War II. But during my interview, I had to put my pencil down when he casually mentioned that, coming back from a mission, he came face to face with the Luftwaffe. Well, I think Ed should tell the rest of the story himself. So this is Ed Cottrell, 48th Fighter Group, St. Tron de Belgium, and we're coming up on December 17th, 1944.
We were in St. Tron, Belgium. We had arrived there in October from Ilsheim in France, and St. Tron, Belgium is just north and I guess west of Bastogne, and then north of Bastogne is Liège. And we were flying in December, and it wasn't very good weather, but that time of the year, I can remember it was the coldest winter that they had had in Germany and Belgium and Holland and France. And there's lots of snow, and it was. We were flying. Then all of a sudden, the weather about the 20th, 21st of December, the weather just went sour. And nobody could fly, and we were sitting at the airfield, and we'd heard all these rumors about the Germans were breaking through, and there was a big battle going on, and the Americans were in command to the north and to the south, but the Germans had broken through at this area called Bastogne, and I can remember on Christmas the telling us that the Germans were breaking through, and not that at any time if the Americans couldn't stem them, why we might be overrun by Germans, and we were hoping that we could get into the air, and the weather was just horrible. So we sat there, I can remember that every day a group of four pilots would go down to the airfield and sit on what we call runway alert, which was four planes placed at the end of the runway. So if radar picked up anybody, well, the planes could take off or picked up anything. So New Year's Eve, we had been told that the Germans had broken through, and we were going to be taken prisoners. They were going to overrun the airfield, and we were to burn all our personal things. The only thing that we would have would be our dog tags and everything. And so we went to bed. I can remember New Year's Eve, and I never drank anything while I was flying. And I can remember on New Year's Eve that a group of us got together and said, well, if we're going to be prisoners of war, we might as well have a couple drinks before we get captured. And I can remember chugging a couple shots of scotch, and I never drank. And I went to bed. I was zonked out. And at about 4 o'clock on New Year's Day, I was awakened and said, you're on runway alert. And so you know what happened on New Year's Day when the Germans hit every airfield along the way in a last-ditch effort in order to help the fight that was going on in Bastogne. And they took a big loss that day. But that's pretty much what I remember about the Battle of the Bulge.
How far was St. Tron from the front line?
I would think that it was probably about 15 to maybe 20 miles.
So once go ahead.
We were supporting the Ninth Army, and the Ninth Army had been up to the north, and they had been pulled down towards Bastogne to try to help relieve. And you know that I didn't know at that time, but Patton's army had heard about, and he was from the south, and so there was all a big mixture in there. But we were probably 15 to 20 miles from Bastogne.
So when I think they called it Operation Bodenplatt, is that was the?
Remember what they really what they called, to be honest with you.
But when was St. Tron attacked by the Luftwaffe on January 1st?
Yes. Our airfield was hit by, I think it was about eight FW-190s, or maybe there were 109, but I remember the 190s. And I was in the lead plane sitting on the runway. We had four planes parked there at an angle. And we didn't have our motors running because you wait till you hear from the controller, the radar, if there's anything in the area. Well, apparently these planes came in so low to the ground, the radar didn't pick them up. But the first thing I remember that this group of German planes went right over the field, came in over the end of the runway. And we had a burned-out B-17 and a B-24 that were parked in the middle of where the runways crossed. There were two runways on at St. Tron. They were both about 10,000 feet concrete, and they made an X. And the 117 was parked on one side and the 24 on the other. They were burned out, and they had landed there after being hit on raids into Germany, and the fighters went right for those two planes, and they didn't drop their belly tanks. And so when they came off their run, they pulled up, and the anti-aircraft knocked two or three of them out of the ground, right down into the ground. And I can remember sitting there, and as soon as they went to that thing, we all got out of our planes because there's no way we could take off with P-47. If we would never have gotten off the ground by the time they made a turn. And so the first pass, they were, I was in the plane. The second pass that they came around, the anti-aircraft were shooting at, and we were on the, I was on the ground by the front wheel. And I watched the plane come down, and he was shooting. He saw us there, and he was shooting at us on the ground. And the third pass, as they came down, there was a ditch behind the end of the runway, and we were all in that ditch, and a FW-190 came down and went right into the ground on the end of the runway. Maybe 100 feet from where we are, it hit in there and exploded in the body. You could see I saw the pilot come out, and when we went over after it was over, he had a bullet hole in the middle of his forehead. He was a young kid. I mean, couldn't have been more than 17, 18 years of age. And that was how desperate they were. They didn't drop their belly tanks, and the anti-aircraft, he was the only one that was left coming down the runway in the third pass.
Huh. That had to be a horrifying moment.
It was. I mean, every time I seeing that plane hit into the ground and this body flying out, and it's at the time you're young and it happens so fast that you don't know what's happening. But then when you sit down 70 years later, and you say, man, what a thing to happen to somebody, but it's all, you know, it just happens so fast. The sure. whole thing.
So when you think about those memories, I have a question. How clear are they in your mind? Are they foggy, or can you bring them up?
No, they're still clear. I can remember coming home after I got finished in, I guess it was in July. I got home before I got was going to be discharged, and we were so used to every time we flew, FLAC was, you know, the anti-aircraft guns were going off. And so if I were in bed at night and a truck backfired, I'd fall right out of bed and hit the floor. I mean, that's how much it affects you, you know, when you, and those B-17 and 24 and B-25 and 26 pilots that had got a lot flack, a lot more than we ever got. We got a lot, but they really got hit with anti-aircraft guns. They still probably, or if their pilot's alive, they still have that problem.
Sure. Huh. I heard about that act of desperation. I was at Y-29, which was another field, and the 352nd were there, and they managed to get some airplanes up. But other pilots have commented about how the pilot that I was there, he commented how he felt like it was such a waste to go up against an enemy that was obviously young and inexperienced. It made him mad.
Yeah, I can remember the on our missions in September and October and November, the 17 and 24 pilots used to remember how strong the German fighters were, you know, as they got in over Germany. But with all those raids that were taking place at that time, the German Luftwaffe got hit really bad by those gunners and on the 17s and 24s. I mean, they lost a lot of planes trying to bring our bombers down.
And
you could just see that, you know, with our group, we had experienced pilots. I joined the outfit in, I think it was September, and some of the guys were still there when we finished the war in May. Some of our older pilots.
Right. So you were flying with people, you know, and that knew what they were doing. And the Luftwaffe, of course, was down to, well, as you said, 18-year-old kids.
Yeah, when they were at that, by January, they had lost a lot of planes, and they were searching for pilots. You could tell, because any pilot that flies a plane with a belly tank knows that when you get close to somebody going to shoot at you, you better get rid of that belly tank, because that's just like sitting on a furnace.
Well, now, I want to talk about your particular mission, and you know what that one's about. But up until then, can you describe a typical P-47 mission that you flew, maybe in September or October?
Yeah, most of our missions were, like I said, in support of the 9th Army, and we were the, as they went into battle and as they moved forward, we went from like outside of Paris up to Saint-Tron, Belgium, which was closer to the 9th Army. They were going up through France up into Belgium and Holland and going across to Germany that way. And a typical mission for us would be anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours. We would go out, and most of the time we went out with 12 planes, and we would listen to what the tank commanders, whether they would tell us what was holding them up or where the combat was and where we needed to be to look to see if we could dive bomb and strafe to help them And so we were hitting mostly tanks and railroad trains and trucks and troops along the front line. And I can you always knew where the front line was because our tanks had colors on which identified them as friendly tanks.
So what color would that be? What did that look
well,
like?
Well, each day it changed.
Really?
Yep, they would tell you when you went a mission what the color of the day was.
And where was that painted? On the turret?
They had whatever it was. It was on the top of the tank. You could just see it. You know, it would stand out.
And so
there weren't not every tank didn't have a color on it. It was just the lead ones. You could identify where the bomb line was very easy by the way the troops and the tanks were all.
How close are you coming in? Are you right on the deck or are you at 1,000?
We're probably up 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 feet. And so that we can, we're going to be hit as we do low, go down to strafe, we're going to be hit with small arms, but where we are at 25, nothing's bothering us. We can search ground without having to worry about small arms. When you start to go in to strafe, that's when you get small arms from the opponent, from the Germans.
When I drew your P-47, R. Mary, I put armor-piercing bombs on that. And, because you were, how often would you be going against tanks?
Well, we were almost every mission we were told to be on the lookout for tanks because the Germans had a lot of tanks. You know, they just had a lot of tanks and they were big tanks. Most of our bombs were armor piercing.
Hmm. And I have a question. You know, the 850s on a P-47, would that hurt a Tiger tank?
The 50 probably would not disable a Tiger tank. You had to hit it with bomb, but the 50 calibers would take care of railroad cars, take care of trucks and troop movement and things like that. But a 50 caliber machine gun not going to do anything to an armored tank.
So
a
did
Tiger
you
tank.
Yeah. Did you see was the Luftwaffe up like in did you see them much in October and November of 44?
No, most of the Luftwaffe was going against the 17s and the 24s. You know, at that time in September and October, they were bombing Germany. You know, they were trying to hit all the factories and they were taking off from England and going into Germany. And as I said, the German fighters were the German army was more afraid of the 17s and the 24s than they were against the 51s and the 47s. The 51s were flying escort for the 17s and 24s. We flew very few escort missions. I can remember maybe only one or two escort missions, and the most we could go was a 3-hour mission with belly tanks.
Right, because the fuel consumption on our
P-47. Yeah, because of the fuel consumption. Where the 51s, you know, they had the inline engine and they could go a lot further. They were much less use of fuel. The 47 used a lot of fuel.
Well, that's a good segue because you've one of your most distinguished missions. Was that December 16th or December 17th?
December 17th.
17th, right. Okay.
Yeah.
So take us through that day from your mission briefing to the incredible thing that happened.
As I remember, I don't remember too much about the briefing because, again, we were doing like we do every day. The mission was called. We were to support the Ninth Army, and our flight leader that day was our commanding officer. It was Major Lachelet at that time, Stanley Lachelet, and I was that day. I was flying wing to Major Lachelet, and we were going out looking for tanks or whatever we could. We were to support the Ninth Army, and so I can remember going out, and Major Lachelet called. He said that they reported that there were some Tiger tanks in this area, and they were in the woods. And so I can remember him feeling going down, and I was second behind him. And as we went down, I dropped my bombs. I could see the tanks, and I dropped my bomb and pulled up out. And as I pulled up, I never saw so many fighter planes in my life. They're just going past us and turning all around. And Major Lachelet was in front. He was pulled up, and I was going up to catch up to him. And all of a sudden, I saw this 109 to my right, and it was going towards him. And I turned my plane to meet towards him to try to fire at him. And as I was going up, and he was coming down, and then I saw that nose gun blinking, that cannon in the nose blinking, and all of a sudden, I had a big explosion, and I had oil all over my windshield. I mean, I was completely covered with black oil, and I was climbing up, still going up, and he had gone past. And from then on, it was a matter of my engine started to quit, and I called my flight leader, and everybody was in confusion. I know that because everybody, as they came off from dropping their bombs, were in combat with these German, and we lost two pilots that day. Two of my buddies. Well, one was a good buddy. The other was an older pilot. James Watson was an older pilot. He'd been in the group for a while. Art Summers, who got shot down that day, joined the outfit the same time as I did. He and I came to the outfit together. But I can remember just telling my flight leader that I was hit and I was probably going to have to bail out because I didn't think the engine would keep going. And he said, well, take it as far as you can, hit 270, and good luck. And it just kept chugging, and I just started heading west. And then all of a sudden, I looked out to my right, and there was a 109. And I looked to my left, and there was a 109. And they apparently had throttled back. And then all of a sudden, they crisscrossed. They both dropped below and crisscrossed because the one on the left banked up on the right and the one on the right banked up on the left. And then they came in real close and flew along while I was chugging. And I guess I was going at the most, maybe 130 mile an hour, just above stalling speed. And just kept chugging. I had the canopy back. There was black oil all in front, and the only way I knew was looking out the side. And then when I don't know where we were, and all of a sudden The one on the right just made a circle with his thumb and his finger and then peeled off to the right. And I looked, and the one on the left he peeled off to the left. And that's the last I saw of him. And I just kept going, and I was on my radio asking for where anybody picked me up, and where I didn't know where I was, because eventually I found out that I was south of our airfield, and we never landed from the south to the north. We always came into the north over Aachen and would circle the airfield and then land, because of the prevailing winds that were always there in Belgium. So this time when this happened, we were south of St. John, but not very far. Apparently, as Major Latchley, because we got hit over Koblenz. We were over Koblenz when we got hit.
Yeah.
And so if you look on the map, Koblenz is a little bit south, and So that's apparently why I came in south of the airfield. But somebody in Italy picked me up, because I asked he asked where I was, and I said I have no idea, and he said, "What's your airfield?" And I said A-92, and he said, "Well, you're not too far from it if you take if you make a 90-degree turn and keep chugging, you ought to run into it." And I said, "Well, where are you?" And he said, "Italy."
Oh, and, on the radio.
On the radio, yes. He said, I'm in Italy, but I've picked you up and heard you." And it wasn't long after that I spotted the airfield. And as I came in, I just came in, and as I touched down, why, the engine froze up completely, and I just coasted down the runway. I couldn't get it started. They had to come out and get it off the runway.
What did your airplane? Your airplane was R. Mary. That's the one I drew. But what did it look like?
The windshield was completely black. There was oil on the right side of the hole, down the right side of the airplane, and some bullet holes. From their 50 caliber shots, but there weren't that many. But the main thing was the 20 millimeter cannon, and you could see where it hit, right where the wing joined onto the fuselage. And there was a big hole there. And then the crew chief told me that 8 cylinders had been knocked out. When they
really
finally got it off and they went to work, there were 8 cylinders that were gone.
What happened to
and
the airplane?
That thing still flew with 8 cylinders out.
Wow. Was it repaired?
I don't know what they did with it, because after it was over, I know that they drove me over to briefing, and I don't remember too much after that, because I was in shock too. It was a pretty harrowing experience, and I don't know what they did. I know the plane flew, they had it repaired, because that plane flew again.
Okay.
Huh. They probably put a whole new engine in it.
Amazing. So you had your life spared. Those 109s could have blown you right out of the sky.
Yeah, they could have blown me right out of the sky. They wouldn't have even had to fight for the fire of their guns. They could have just forced me down. They could have stayed right on top of me and just kept forcing me down.
Why do you think they let you off? Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I have a lot of times, I know that I myself would never hit a crippled person or thing. You learned that when I was young. You never took it. If somebody was hurt, you didn't go after them.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it was never said or never said, but I'm sure about pilots that nobody wanted to that was had any feelings would try to hit a crippled person.
Right. So you felt you were given mercy.
I would love to meet those two. I wish that I had had a chance during the years after that to meet those two. I'd have no idea who were they. They don't know who I was. I just know we were in combat and they spared my life.
Do you recall what those 109s looked like? I mean, because maybe you could identify a squadron or.
I had no idea. I knew they were 109s. I didn't pay any attention to anything else. I just knew there were 109s. I knew it was a 109 that fired at me, and I have no idea other than
that. Right. It's not like you were sitting in the cockpit thinking, you know, 70 years from now, I might have to know these markings.
Yep. I have no idea and I'm not sure that they even knew what ours looked like.
How do you get over the shock of something like that so you can go back and fly missions? Because you flew more combat.
And I think this we had our commanding officer, Major Lachelet. I can remember him getting hit prior to that on a mission. And as soon as he landed, the first thing he said, "We got to go back. I got to go back right up, and I've got to go back up right away." And so I can remember after the briefing and talking to him, and he said, "You've got to fly another mission right away, so as soon as possible. So I'm scheduling you for the next mission." And that's the way you get over that. Because the minute you go out for a mission, you got to either be ready to go and concentrate and do what you're supposed to do, everything that you can to get yourself back. And the only way you can do that is to be in actual combat. There's no, you learn by experience.
We're so close to the Pentagon. Sometimes they ask us to get the coffee. This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the all-new Warbird Radio Live channel. We're happy to be back on the air right across from the runway at Washington Reagan International Airport. Be sure and tune in Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern each week for Warbird Radio Live, followed by a new episode of one of our top-tier shows like the RC Scale Builders Show, Hartman and Hines, Over the Front, and the all-new Texas Warbird Report and Wings Over New Zealand Show. Listen, this station is all about community, so please join up with us on Tuesday nights and call in and become part of the fun and part of the family. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Welcome back to Warbird Radio Presents. I'm John Mollison, and now we conclude the Ed Cottrell story.
My last mission was in May, probably a day before the end of the war, and it was nothing more than just a routine takeoff and search the area for, because everybody knew the war was over. It was just a matter of when the Germans were going to surrender, and we were out on a mission. We were still supporting the Ninth Army, and the mission didn't last, but it was my 65th mission, which if the war hadn't ended would have qualified me to go home for rotation before I would have gone back into combat after I had time at home.
Sure. But, now you were flying a P-47N then, right? What was the name of your plane? What was the name of your plane?
The plane that I had then was Feet of Heaven. In March, I had become a father, and my wife gave birth to our first child on March 23rd, and I got a victory letter from my mother-in-law telling that I was the father of a baby girl, and the next that a letter would come, and they would have footprints of the little girl, and so that came, and they put footprints, not those, but they put what the footprints looked like, and then I named it Feet of Heaven.
I'm going to have to draw that airplane. What's your daughter's name, just out of curiosity?
Her name, surprisingly, is Mary Carolyn.
Huh. So
isn't that odd?
Yeah, our Mary was the one you got shot up in, and Mary Carolyn. Well, we're going to have to
do hers.
It's
the name of our daughter, but she goes by Carol. She doesn't go, but my mother-in-law's name was Mary, too.
Interesting.
And so that plane that I got was, it's eerie, when you stop and think about it.
Yeah. So describe what it was like when you heard that the war was over. Can you recall that day?
Yeah, I can remember that the war was over, and they called us into the briefing room and said that the Germans were surrendering, and the 48th Fighter Group was going to be shipping out ships to go to Japan. The war with Japan was still going on. And those that had enough missions could either stay with the outfit or they could opt to go home. And I opted to go home because I had dad, our daughter, which I'd never seen. And I guess maybe about four or five of us opted to go home. The rest chose to stay with the outfit and go over to Japan. And I can remember that if those that stayed got promoted, and we who went home did not get promoted. And so the guys that I went over with that stayed had gone to captains, and I was a first lieutenant. And so when I got home, I was home when the war with Japan ended. When I got down to San Antonio to be discharged, the guys that were on their way to Japan had come back. They had stopped their ship, and they came back. And the guys that were my buddies that were captains, I was a lieutenant. And that promotion followed me all the way through my reserve career. So that when I had been in the reserves until 28th year, you can't get promoted after the 28th year. And I was like 2 or 3 weeks from being promoted to full colonel, and I couldn't because the 28 years ran out. And that just followed the whole way along. It's amazing how the Army works or the Air Force works. But that's the way it is.
But it was worth it. You got to see your daughter.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I made the right decision. I would not that I wasn't but I was ready to go home.
Yeah. So what'd you do after the war? What describe your life? What'd you do?
Well, when I was going to be discharged, and before I went into the service, I was at a school called Slippery Rock State Teachers College. My father taught there, and I was had gone through 3.5 years of training to be a health and physical education teacher and a coach. And so while I was I got called into service in February of 43, And my class graduated in May of 43, and my wife was in that same class. So while I was in flight training, when graduation on May, I was received notification that I was granted my degree, even though I wasn't finished my last 12 weeks of student teaching. So when I got in 45, when I got home, I started looking for a job, and I can remember being down in San Antonio and getting a notice, a telegram that I had gotten a job at a high school in Beaver, Pennsylvania, as a teacher of health and physical education and as the basketball coach. And so that was the starting of my teaching career. And I was, so in September of 45, I started teaching, and I still had to wear my uniform because I wasn't completely discharged yet. And I had to wait, I don't know how many days, until it was official. And so I taught in my my classes in my Air Force uniform. And then I coached the basketball team. And fortunately, there were a lot of good players on that team because the coach wasn't that good of a coach. But we won a lot of games. We lost to the what turned out to be the Pennsylvania State High School champion team. We lost to them twice. Those were the only two games we lost. But our kids might have won that if they'd have had a better coach that was more experienced and knew more what he was doing. But anyway, near the end of the year, that spring, I can remember a fella in a Navy uniform coming in to the school, and he introduced himself to me, and he said, you know, I'm coming back to school. I was the old basketball coach. Well, I didn't know there was a guy had left as coach, and the superintendent never told me that job was being held for somebody else. So automatically he had the job. It was his job. And so I can remember the superintendent calling and said, well, he chooses to come back, so we'll make you as his assistant. And so I told my wife, we're going to look for a, because I don't think this will work out too good. And it didn't take long for me to get another job down at a school called Neville Island, which was probably 15 miles on the down from the Beaver. Beaver was on the Ohio River, and Neville Island was closer to Pittsburgh on the Ohio River. And it was a very small school, and I coached football, basketball, and baseball at that school and taught physical education. And then I was there for 5 years, and during that time I took my master's degree at the University of Pittsburgh, and I coached the three sports. And then I was at a crossroads where my wife and I discussed what we were going to do, and I said I would like to go on and get an advanced degree because I'd like to go into college teaching and so forth. And so I made an application to Pennsylvania State University for a graduate assistantship in health and physical education, and received a graduate assistantship. So I spent 2 years at Penn State earning my doctorate degree. And from there, I wrote my dissertation and did all my studies and everything. We lived at State College for 2 years. And while I was at State College on a graduate assistantship, which didn't pay a lot of money, I had, in the meantime, I had another child, so we had two young kids, our oldest daughter, and then we had one that was 4 years younger. And so there, the youngest one was about a year to 2 years old. And while I was at State College, I delivered mail in that Christmas time in a couple feet of snow, and I worked in a gas station on weekends, pumping gas and manning the gas station at night, so that part of my pay was ice cream for the kids and milk that was ready to be disposed I could take home and use and things like that in order to get by, because graduate assistance didn't pay very much. And so then when I graduated from, when I got my doctorate degree, I was looking for a job, and the athletic directorship and the director of running the physical education program at a boys' school at Hershey, Pennsylvania, Milton Hershey School, which was an a school for orphan boys, funded by Milton Hershey, the Hershey candy bars.
Right.
And they have that. They still have that school. It sat in the town of Hershey, and they had a big hotel up in the hill, and the school was right up in front of the hotel, and the airfield was down at the bottom of the hill, and the big Hershey Stadium was there where our teams played. And Hershey was had a high school, and then they had this orphan school for orphan boys, which was the Milton Hershey School. It used to be called the Hershey Industrial, but it changed its name to Milton Hershey.
Here's a question. You know, you went in, you became a teacher, and interacting with kids. Did your military experience help you be a teacher at all?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, it teaches you a lot of things. It teaches you discipline. You have to be disciplined, and you have to rely on other people. I mean, if you don't have respect for each other, you're the helping the other person, protecting their back, they're protecting your back, and you learn from service that respect for other people and trust are two very, very important items. You've got to trust people, and you've got to respect them. And that's what I tried to preach to all my teams and to all the people that you work with, that physical education, the skills you learn are fine, but you learn things about what are going to carry you on through life, and I learned that very quickly by combat. I grew up very fast. When I went into combat, I was like all college kids. You know, I was going to school, having a good time and everything. And when you become and you're a father and you've got to support a family and you've got to do the things that you promised you would do, you've got to then grow up very fastly. And that service, that military service, made me grow up very rapidly.
Did it? How did you impart what you learned to your kids, to your students?
I don't know. It's just the way, and I always treated my students as they were just people that they wanted to learn, and they wanted you to discipline them. They wanted you to teach discipline.
Okay, well, here's a question, Ed, that I ask a lot of, you know, what I say old guys, and I know you don't take offense to that. If you were to go out to lunch with one of my kids and impart your life's wisdom, but what would you say?
I would tell them to just respect your mother and father, and You know, the family is the greatest thing there is. If you have good family values and you believe in respect and you believe in you're a good Christian, your family's going to do okay.
Yeah.
There's a difference between spoiling a kid and being love between kids, you know.
Yeah, right.
And it's hard to explain, but right now, at 93 years, I have a daughter that's 69. Well, she's 70. She'll be 70 in the 23rd. And I have one that's 66. And our family's close. And I'm fortunate to have two great kids. I've never had a problem with them. We have great Christmases together, and we talk on the phone all the time. That to me is makes my life great because we're a very close family.
How many years have you been married?
We'll be 71 in April.
What's your secret to 71 years of marriage?
Well, when somebody asks me that, I say, drink lots of water and marry a good woman. And I've married the greatest lady. My wife, I met her in college as a freshman. We were both freshmen. And surprisingly, my best friend, who I grew up from elementary school all the way through college, he had a date with her before I did, and he told me, he said, you need to ask her out. And I said, well, why are you telling me? He said, you know who I'm trying to date. And he was trying to date a local girl. We both went to school at Slippery Rock, and we both graduated from Slippery Rock High School. So I asked her out. It was about maybe a month after school started in our freshman year, and from then that's the only girl that I dated. And then we got engaged right before I went to the service, and then when I graduated from flying school, I came home on a 3-week leave, and we got married.
Amazing. Well, you know, one thing, Ed, that I have to tell you what was so impressive when we were deciding which P-47 to draw, whether it be the one that honored your daughter or the one that you were flying when you were shot up, you asked your wife's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought that was interesting. That was almost chivalrous of you to ask your wife. And so you showed her respect, you know? I thought that was cool, Ed.
Yeah. Well, my wife and I, we're very fortunate. We are. We're both in pretty good health for 93 years. We're able to go around, and she's out playing bridge today, and we're going to have one of my former players here tomorrow night. We'll be having a nice weekend. Our kids are healthy. We're healthy, and so... you know, she and I have had a great 71 years, and she's the love of my life. I mean, I was the most fortunate person in the world to be able to meet her and to marry her.
You know,
and I felt that from the day I met her, I knew she was going to be my wife.
You know, I think, you know, in a weird way, Ed, we've got two German pilots to thank for all of what you've had, and you know, probably dedicate this interview to those guys who saw to the gentleman conduct of sparing your life.
Yep, those two. If it hadn't been from them, I would never have had the experiences I've had over the years. And I've had a great life. I've had a great retirement. I retired in 1980. Which is 35 years ago, and I've had the greatest retirement anybody could have. and fortunate that and it could never have happened if these two guys had not felt the way they did about giving me the opportunity to live.
Right. Well, Ed, I tell you what, I think we're done. And
okay.
I just want to tell you, this is from drawing your airplane and getting to know you and finding out what makes you tick. It's just been a pure honor. And thank you for everything. This has been terrific.
Well, you're welcome, John. As I told you, I feel like I'm a humble person. I want to be a humble person, and I am not a anybody special than any other American that was in World War II that's still alive, and they appreciate that we live in a great country. We're fortunate to be able to do what we have, the freedoms that we have, and the ability to make our own decisions, and what we each one would do again, whatever they have to do to keep that. That freedom is the greatest thing in the world, in my estimation.
When I finished Ed's P-47 and posted it to my blog, I got a surprise. One, two, three, and many more of Ed's athletic students latched onto it and let me know that I was dealing with their hero. Ed Cottrell wasn't just a fighter pilot. He was a leader, and it had nothing to do with war. The man had become a legend, not as a fighter pilot, but as a coach. This interview and my artwork of Ed's P-47 is dedicated, though, to those Luftwaffe pilots who decided to let honor be the better part of valor and let Ed Cottrell live. To those Luftwaffe pilots, there are so many who have reaped the reward of your mercy. Thank you. If this story has inspired you or you'd like a picture of Ed's P-47 signed by Ed himself, please go to johnmollison.com. And I hope to share another story with you on a future Warbird Radio Presents.